then, I will proudly take my place on the Mount Rushmore of terrible assistants. Alone. I know there are other bad assistants out there, I'm sure of it, but I refuse to share my title as the worst in the world. The one when I binged Friends. We all have heroes. In 2009, a young boy from Singapore named Joseph Schooling met his hero Michael Phelps. 7 years later, Schooling would beat Phelps at the 2016 Rio Olympics in the 100-meter butterfly. Naomi Osaka grew up in Long Island, New York, idolizing Serena Williams. At 20, she would compete against Williams in the U.S. Open and win. When I heard Robert De Niro was suing his former assistant for, among many other things, watching 55 episodes of Friends in 4 days while at work, I can only imagine I felt the same thing Schooling and Osaka felt when they first saw their heroes excel. 55 episodes? In 4 days? While at work? I had never been so in awe of anyone. A small piece of me thought, 55 episodes? I could do better than that. Luckily, one of our writers thought it was an excellent idea that I should devote my week to beating De Niro's assistant's record. Each episode of Friends is about 22 to 23 minutes long. To watch 55 episodes, you'd have to allot 1,265 minutes of your life, or a little over 21 hours. To watch 55 episodes, you'd have to watch about 5.5 hours of Friends per day for 4 days straight. To make things even more difficult, my workday starts at 10 a.m., and I would have until we taped at 4:30 p.m. to watch as many episodes as possible. That's 6.5 hours of time I had to watch 5.5 hours of TV just to keep up with De Niro's assistant. I cracked my knuckles and got to work. For 4 days, I binged. I laughed. I cried. I started forcing my friends to meet me in coffee shops. I would move sofas with unwilling pals just so I could yell, "Pivot!" I stopped giving the middle finger and started pounding my fists together. I became the living embodiment of Friends. At the end of the 4-day timeline, I had watched 58 episodes, like a motherfucking champion. As a gift from Conan for beating De Niro's assistant's record, I got all 58 episodes I watched on VHS, a basket full of marijuana edibles, and 6 puppies, named after each of the main characters on Friends. I guess I should rewind a bit and explain how I became so brazen about watching TV at work. When I first started interning at NBC, I noticed that everybody who worked there had a TV either at their desk or in their office. When working in television, wouldn't it make sense to have a television at your disposal? It's there to watch the shows you're working on, to watch edits of various episodes and keep up with the content you're distributing globally. It's also to keep up with whatever is going on in the world. Is someone from a show you're working on stopping by The View? Then you should watch the interview on your TV. Is Extra going to do a special segment on the show you're adapting from a popular novel? Then here's your TV to stay in the know. Somewhere down the line, I noticed no one ever cared what you were watching. It's not like they could keep up with how every show was being promoted, and they could never say something you were watching was impertinent to your job because no one ever really knew, so I made it a habit to have the TV on all the time. When I was the events and operations coordinator, my desk was in the common area in the middle of all these offices, and the TV I watched was affixed to the wall. That's when I learned I could watch Jerry Springer every day at a very high volume. I can't imagine how annoying it was to everyone I worked with, and I'm shocked no one ever said anything about it. I do remember a lot of the office doors remained closed throughout the entire day, and now I wonder if my regularly scheduled programming might have had something to do with it. Regardless, passively watching television for work eventually became just watching television because it's there. And that's how they thought of me for this segment, through my brazen and widely known disregard for office etiquette and my unapologetic attitude toward watching TV at work. Anyway, the day after I beat the Friends binging record, I forced Jeff Ross's assistant, David Hopping, to come with me to all the locations on the Warner Brothers lot where they shot Friends. The following week, I took all the photos and footage I shot visiting the locations on the lot and edited a movie in iMovie with the Friends theme as the background music. I uploaded it to Instagram, but it was taken down within 5 minutes because of copyright infringement. The locations were fine, but I couldn't use the theme song. So I enlisted David again, this time asking him to drop everything he was doing so we could figure out a way to get around the copyright infringement issues with the theme song. I decided the best thing to do would be to sing it myself with David as the backup, the clapper. How much time did I waste? We already know that from Monday to Thursday, I watched almost 23 hours of television. We spent about 5 hours on Friday going to all the locations on the Warner Brothers lot. I spent another 2 hours editing the video and another hour dealing with the Friends copyright infringement debacle on Instagram. All in all, I calculate 31 hours of my work week were completely wasted on this Friends binge challenge. Additionally, if you factor in the breaks I take for the bathroom and lunch and doing the crossword puzzle and socializing, then I'm actually in overtime. I got paid my regular work salary plus overtime plus appearance fees for the show, so I made a nice profit from watching TV at work and doing no real work. Plus, I stole David away for a few hours to help me with the photo shoot and Instagram post. I don't have any Olympic medals, and I've never won a Grand Slam title, but I'm sure whatever schooling and Osaka felt when they beat their idols is a fraction of the joy I felt when I beat Robert De Niro's former assistant's binging record. Like her, I was fortunate enough to find my purpose and excel at my goals. Like her, I will be remembered forever. This is my legacy. My journal during the tour. During the Legally Prohibited from Being Funny on Television tour, I kept a journal. I should rephrase that. For less than the first half of the Legally Prohibited from Being Funny on Television tour, I kept a journal. After our show in San Jose on May 5th, I just stopped. Why? Because I was either eating or drinking and forgot. My unfinished journal is a perfect representation of how I approach things both at work and in my personal life. With gusto in the beginning and a very obvious loss of steam halfway through. Either way, I found my journal and would love to share some snippets of some of the entries with you. April 11th, 2010, Eugene, Oregon. We ended up at a restaurant bar called Steelhead, I think, and I had some of the best beer ever. Debbie Wonder won a small blender at an auction in the lobby. April 12, 2010, Eugene, Vancouver. It was the first day of the show today and the day we announced the TBS deal. Conan had told me about it last week, and I feel like he's really beginning to trust me, so I don't want to screw it all up. April 13, 2010, Vancouver. Vancouver is beautiful. All I've seen of it so far has been one street, but it's beautiful. As I write this, I am quite stoned. My nails are red because I got a Canadian manicure, which is exactly the same as a U.S. manicure. April 15, 2010, Vancouver. Conan and I went to a hat store across from the restaurant because they said they would give him a hat for free. He insisted on paying, so he ended up buying a weird hat for $120. Then we got in a cab, and he told the cab driver that he was a Greek fisherman and that he likes universal healthcare because it comes in handy when the nets come back empty. April 16, 2010, Spokane. After the show, Conan wanted to go to this giant red wagon that's in the park next to the venue, and there were a mob of people, and for the first time on the tour, I got worried. I was a little frazzled, so I decided to go to bed early. Everyone else went to the hotel bar and had a few drinks. They were actually concerned about me the next day since I didn't drink. I love these guys. April 17, 2010, Edmonton. I woke up in Spokane and met Conan and Jeff for breakfast. Then I dragged Conan with me to go on the Sky Tram ride to see the falls. He created this character, Gertie, who is my ugly sister. April 19, 2010, Seattle. We started our day at the Public Market. Later in the day, we went to the Space Needle and went to the very top. We left for the venue and Eddie Vedder destroyed. Backstage, he and I kept shooting the shit. At one point, I introduced myself, and Eddie said, "I know, we've met before at the show." My brain nearly exploded. Everyone left Seattle on such a high. April 22, 2010, San Francisco. We left for San Francisco this morning. We got to the hotel and I went out in search of a stuffed parrot. Conan is transforming into a pirate. April 23, 2010, San Francisco. Chris Isaac came back to play with Conan again. I think our guests really love playing in our show. April 24, 2010. Los Angeles. Los Angeles was crazy. We get to the venue and Conan's dressing room has a giant red piano in the middle of it. Then when you walk into the bathroom, you first see a duvet to the left and then a giant marble shower with dual shower heads. It was incredible. It took me a while to realize I had written duvet when I meant to write bidet. It was embarrassing for me to read that. April 25th, 2010, Los Angeles. I spent the whole day kicking it with Yaya. Right before call time, I went to lunch at Kiwami. Good God, I miss good sushi. The show was awesome. The crowd was better than yesterday's. Everyone hung out for drinks after, but again, Conan was swamped with people in his dressing room. April 29th, 2010, San Diego. After 3 days off, we went to San Diego. It was a half-hour plane ride. I didn't even know you could take a plane to San Diego. The show had one of the best audiences. We didn't stay, and we left for Phoenix that night. April 30th, 2010, Phoenix. Conan and I went to the Arizona Biltmore Hotel, which was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. It was ridiculous, in a good way. I couldn't stop staring at the building. Then on to the show, which was, as usual, great. Las Vegas tonight. May 1st, 2010, Las Vegas. We got into Vegas last night and, ex-boyfriend, happened to be in town. Conan talked me out of calling him, which is good. I know he was upset about it and kind of disappointed, but I needed someone to tell me not to see him. Christina, Veto, and Angina all drove up to stay with me. We went to lunch with Conan and then hung out by the pool. Today's show was a little strange. It was Vegas, so there were a lot of douched-out dudes. They were all drunk. After San Diego and Phoenix, our standards were much higher than that. Later on, we all went up to Conan's suite, which looked like it belonged to a drug overlord. May 2nd, 2010, Las Vegas. The girls left and I was at the craps table, gambling away my per diem. Today's audience was so much better. We had Mike Tyson pull the Walker lever and everyone went crazy. After the show, everyone was having drinks and I started gambling again. I lost a lot of money. May 3rd, 2010, Las Vegas. It was our day off and we were in Las Vegas. Conan and I went to a cafe and then I decided to just hang out in my room all day. At night, Gus, Conan, Andy, Sweeney, and I went to a place called Carnivino at the Palazzo. Probably one of the best dinners I've ever had. May 4th, 2010, Reno. Reno's theater was like dinner theater. There were booths everywhere with tables. It was weird. During the show, I went outside to take photos of the video marquee, and it wasn't even advertising the show. I stood out there for a while in the cold. When I came back inside, I noticed that Sweeney and Matt were at the craps table and Jeff was at the blackjack table. No one was watching the show. I didn't have any cash left, so I sat with Jeff for a bit. May 5th, 2010, San Jose. We all woke up in San Jose and took a van and drove to the Googleplex, which is Google's complex. We get there and there were a ton of eager Google employees who were there to watch a Q&A with Conan. At one point, I went to check out the toilets because they were like duvets. Scratch that. Bidets. Attached to the seat. They were actually heated, which blows my mind. You sit directly on the toilets and the goddamn things are heated. Also, there's a control panel on the side that distinguishes between front cleansing, rear cleansing, and dryer. So I used it and naturally, I started screaming. Andy heard me from outside and talked about it on stage. Everyone at Google laughed at me. And that's it! My journal ends there. I started off so strong and then just stopped after San Jose. I didn't write about taking a bus to the Winchester Mystery House in San Jose by myself when we had some free time and taking a tour of the property. I was looking at a creepy door that led nowhere when I realized I had to hightail it back to the theater where it would be call time soon. It wasn't an exciting day, but it would have been nice to write about in my journal. I didn't write about the band Hanson hanging out in Conan's dressing room in Tulsa before the show and my noticing that they had all grown up nicely, especially the youngest one, Zach, who had been a child when they hit it big and was now quite the dish. I didn't talk about hanging out backstage in Kansas City, where Jason Sudeikis was a guest and waiting for his cue with him while he was drinking a Natty Light. I didn't write about the cool hotel we stayed in while we were in Minneapolis and how Conan had a fun party with the crew in his room. I completely forgot to write about the shit show that was Atlantic City and how we ate in the casino's staff cafeteria and how I never want to see the underbelly of a casino ever again. I didn't write about going to New York City and how exciting it was to work on a show at the legendary Radio City Music Hall. Or how in Boston we went to Conan's 25th college reunion at Harvard and he participated in a talent show and it was like 5 hours long. Or how we went to the Lampoon Castle and I invited three members of the Lampoon back to the hotel. Nothing scandalous, they just seemed fun. And we ordered hundreds of dollars of room service. I didn't write about the nightmare that was Bonnaroo, how it was humid and hot as hell, and how I saw drunk and high festival goers standing under a giant mushroom structure that was spouting water, and how after a day the water had turned brown and these poor young men and women were getting soaked by this disgusting turd water. I didn't write about how cool it was to do a show at Third Man Records in Nashville and how earlier that day we had dropped Conan off at Jack White's house like we were dropping off our child for a play date. I never mentioned the tour bus and how my friend Megan and I watched The Human Centipede on it with the shoddy internet. It took us 4 hours to watch an hour and a half long movie, giving me plenty of time to ponder the film's subtle relevance to my industry. And finally, I didn't talk about our last stop, Atlanta, which happened to be the home of our new network, TBS. We had a meeting with the top brass, and they gave us iPads. It may seem like I remember a lot of what happened on the tour off the top of my head, but I don't. There are cities and dates that I have completely forgotten. If I hadn't written down that I went to the Space Needle in Seattle, then I wouldn't have remembered that I went. If someone had asked me if I had ever been to the Space Needle and I hadn't written it down, I probably would have said no. So why did I stop keeping the journal, you ask? Why stop documenting all the strange and amazing experiences I was having as Conan's assistant? Because I'm lazy. Because instead of taking 5 minutes to jot down memories that I can share with my children and grandchildren, I decided to go to the bar every night and try all the fruity drinks the Four Seasons had to offer. I thought, hey, this can be my thing. I can be the person who tells others to try the sugar rum fairy at the Austin Four Seasons. As if hotels keep the same made-up cocktails for years, and as if anyone cares. I didn't keep a journal because I was too busy eating free food. I gained 25 pounds on that tour, and I really should have seen each pound coming a mile away. When you eat 5 full meals a day and drink every night, weight is bound to be gained. And boy was it. Although, you know what? Worth it. Luckily, Conan's longtime friend Rodman Flender filmed the tour for his documentary Conan O'Brien Can't Stop. It feels like someone filmed the best summer camp I've ever been to, and it fills in some of the gaps after my journal left off and where sugar rum fairies erased my memories. The Conan O'Brien Can't Stop documentary. Have you ever asked yourself, what does an assistant to an iconic late-night host who had a very well-known exit from a network he was at for 16 years eat when that late-night host goes on a multi-city tour? Well, I've got the answers for you. Before I get into it, I just want to say for the record that I am not a television personality. In Conan's orbit, I've found myself in the spotlight more than I ever expected. But still, when a camera is pointed in my boss's direction, I never assume I am in the shot. That explains why I continue to do what I would normally do. When the documentary came out, all I could see was how often I was caught eating on camera. This moving documentary follows a special moment in television history, and according to the video evidence, my part of that history was only to eat. Prominently. The chaos and constant movement of this large tour were all around me, and I spent my time enjoying the free food and drinks American Express sponsored. In fairness, food is fuel, and an assistant marches on her stomach. For example, during lunch at our first rehearsal, we were still figuring out what the actual show was going to be, and we were supposed to leave in a week. I'm on the left, and half my face is cut off, but I am taking a massive bite of a piece of medium-rare tri-tip from catering. I had to sit in so many meetings where the content of the show was discussed. The writers Mike Sweeney and Matt O'Brien would talk to Conan about what the show was going to look like that day. They all worked hard to make the shows as unique to the individual cities as possible. It's the first time I had a good look into Conan's work ethic. No two cities had the same show, and he was involved in every single aspect of what the audience would see. In one frame, I'm in one of these key meetings talking into a banana. As I mentioned, we did shows in Las Vegas, Atlantic City, and Reno. I'm lumping them all together because I lost my per diem in all those cities playing craps. In Las Vegas, I took all $400 of my petty cash and lost it within 6 minutes. I timed it. It's not that I have a gambling problem. I just love to spend money I pretend isn't mine, even though the petty cash is part of my salary. In the beginning of the tour, I really wanted to make sure I was at every show so I could honestly tell Conan how I felt about it. By the time we went to Reno, the 11th stop of a 33-city tour, I was wandering around the casino floor looking for a craps table while Conan was on stage. In Atlantic City at the Borgata Hotel, I ordered tuna tartare. I love tuna tartare. In one shot, you can see me taking my first bite. I look at it, lovingly, and think, that's some good tuna tartare. In another shot, I have a mouthful of food attempting to stay engaged in the conversation. Conan is not big on his birthday. I, however, celebrate my birth month when October rolls around. It was Conan's birthday on tour, so they got him a cake and gave it to him on the plane. He didn't care about it, but I was clearly looking forward to eating it. Conan's 25th college reunion at Harvard coincided with the dates of our tour, so many of us went with him. He walked around the campus where he studied American history and English literature. We visited the dorms where he met his closest friends. We visited the Lampoon Castle and saw the birthplace of Conan's ambitions as a writer and performer. I even ate a slice of pizza with a Cambridge police officer. At Bonnaroo, Conan was obligated to introduce several musicians at the main stage, including Nas and Damian Marley. People had committed him to a variety of appearances and obligations without fully informing him, so he was surprised by the extent of what was expected. This was on top of the two shows he had to perform in a tent at Bonnaroo, which was in Tennessee, in the middle of June. This all happened at the end of the tour, and Conan had lost so much weight and had overworked himself both mentally and physically. So many people were excited to see him, and the outpouring of love and support during such a tough time for Conan meant the world not only to him, but to everyone who worked for him. In one scene, I am listening to Mike Sweeney and Conan talk about the intros for the acts at Bonnaroo. Then my sandwich came, and I remember this sandwich clearly. I remember it was big. Way too big. The kind of big where you look at a sandwich and try to figure out a strategy. Do you bite toast to toast in one big bite, or do you do two small bites? It's evident in the documentary which strategy I went for, which was one big bite. And that was my experience on the tour. I'm grateful that these moments were captured on film so my family can see what I was able to accomplish during a pivotal moment in my boss's career. Was I emotionally there for Conan as he was struggling with the realization that his time at the network that helped him build his late-night legacy had come to an end? Most of the time, yes. And I had a mouthful of food while I was doing it. The White House Correspondents' Dinner. In 2013, Conan was tapped to host the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Of all the great events I got to attend, the White House Correspondents' Dinner was the most exciting one for me. It was where everyone from politics, media, and the entertainment industry would converge and interact with one another. It was a massive ball in a massive ballroom, and I was thrilled to have the opportunity to go. Though my work ethic can often lack, Conan's and Mike Sweeney's work ethics are astounding. They are both already so naturally funny, but on top of their innate senses of humor, they care deeply about the comedy they create. This is why they worked on Conan's White House Correspondents' Dinner speech up until the absolute last minute. This type of work ethic, however, poses a problem for at least one person. The person who is walking aimlessly around the hotel waiting for the final notes. The same person who ends up spending ages looking for the business center so she can print out the speech on a series of note cards from which Conan is going to read. Who was that chump, you ask? Why, it was me. We were all getting ready in the hotel where the dinner was taking place, so it was chaos. The first time I went down to the business center to print the notes, it was just the staff preparing the room for the guests, and I felt no sense of urgency. I remember printing out the cards, then checking to make sure they were all in the proper order and casually reading some and chuckling. Here are some of my favorite jokes from Conan's speech. But President Obama, you had some great jokes, and it was a pleasure watching you stand up here and do what I do. So now it's only fair that I get to do what you do. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, for the next 15 minutes, I'll be mired in a tense, dysfunctional standoff with Congress. Congratulations to C-SPAN for winning the bid to broadcast this event. They narrowly beat out HGTV2, QVC South America, and the Hilton Hotel How to Check Out channel. But as I look out at all of the media here with us tonight, I realize this is all just one big high school cafeteria. Think about it. Fox is the jocks, MSNBC is the nerds, bloggers are the goths, NPR is the table for kids with peanut allergies, Al Jazeera is the weird foreign exchange student that nobody talks to. And print media, I didn't forget you. You're that poor kid who died sophomore year in a car crash. But cheer up, we dedicated the yearbook to you. It's hard to believe the Republicans didn't fare better in the election with the support of celebrities like Ted Nugent and Meatloaf. I guess they overestimated the number of voters who still drive carpeted vans. There's RNC Chairman Rince Priebus. You heard me correctly. His name is Rince Priebus. Tonight, he's sitting right between his brothers Lather Priebus and Repeat Priebus. It's no surprise that Speaker John Boehner isn't here tonight. Speaker Boehner and President Obama are still struggling to get along. President Obama and John Boehner are like a blind date between Anderson Cooper and Rachel Maddow. In theory, they understand each other's positions, but deep down, you know that's never going to happen. I would print the speech, go back to the room, Sweeney and Conan would make changes, and I would head back downstairs to the business center to print the speech again. This happened so many times, and over the course of so many hours, I began, uncharacteristically, to feel the sense of urgency I'd initially lacked. I didn't have time to check anything. I would print, grab the cards, and just glance through them in the elevator on the way up, praying they were all okay. The Secret Service eventually came into the picture. Because the President of the United States was going to be there, keeping disheveled-looking young women who were walking around in flip-flops and holding a mountain of blue note cards away from the main ballroom was literally their job. Unfortunately, the ballroom happened to be steps away from the business center. When I walked down to print out the speech for the umpteenth time, a nice but stern Secret Service agent stopped me and began asking a series of questions. Are you a guest in the hotel? No, but we have a couple rooms here because I work for Conan O'Brien and he's speaking tonight. He looks me up and down suspiciously. Do you have any identification? I don't, but I promise I work for him. This is his speech tonight, I say as I hold up a pile of blue note cards with jokes on them. After a few more questions, he lets me access the business center, but not before he says, the next time you come down here, you need to be wearing a dress or whatever outfit you're wearing tonight. Of course, thank you so much, sir. I promise I won't let you down. Followed by a giggle and a smile because flirting never hurt anyone. I walk toward the business center and realize it's now cocktail hour for the dinner because everyone, meaning all of Hollywood's and Washington's power players, is meandering around near the business center and I'm sticking out big time. People are wearing stunning gowns and tuxedos and I'm in my jeans, t-shirt, and flip-flops looking like a complete dick. When I get to the business center after printing out this speech countless times, the printer is suddenly not working. It's stressful enough to print out a speech that some of the most important people in politics and news will listen to, but it's another thing when you need to figure out the settings to get everything printed on 5x7 blue note cards. I'm sweating. Sweeney is calling me to ask why I'm taking so long. It's nearly time for Conan and a few others to head to a pre-dinner meet and greet with President Obama, and I'm holding everyone up. I sweat even more. At this point, there are several hotel staffers trying to help me with the printer. It keeps jamming, and I keep mentally updating my resume. After what feels like an eternity, we get it to work, and I run back upstairs, and again, there are changes. This is the last time, I'm told. I remember what the Secret Service agent told me, so I put on my dress, but there's no way I'm running around in heels, so I stick on my flip-flops again. When I get back downstairs, I nod at the Secret Service agent and gesture to my dress. He does not remember me, but he lets me through. I print out the speech one final time. At this point, the hotel staff working in the business center have become my best friends. We've bonded so much through my trauma that I think about suggesting we all get matching tattoos that say, "I survived the WHCD 2013," alongside a graphic of a printer. When I finally leave the business center for the last time, I give a thumbs up to the hotel staffer sitting at the table and say, "This will probably be the last time I come down here tonight." He barely looks up from his computer and says, uneventfully, "Have a lovely evening." I stand there awkwardly, hoping he'll give me more. He doesn't. I'm glad then that we didn't get the tattoos. I go back upstairs and hand Conan all the cards. He and Sweeney express their gratitude, and then everyone leaves and I'm there. Alone. This is what my job is. A night where I stress out over the smallest of mishaps because I understand the stakes. The mishaps are guaranteed. The consequences could actually be as severe as ruining Conan's White House correspondent's dinner speech. But no one sees that part. They just see me leave the hotel room, then come back with all the blue note cards they need. If they notice the sweat or the flip-flops, no one ever says. Conan delivered his speech and did a great job, and I wanted to get up there during the applause and say, "I printed that speech!" Even as I type this recollection, I realize how uneventful it must seem. Well, to everyone except the assistants in the room, who I'm sure can feel my stress viscerally. But those hiccups are all I remember. I don't remember who I saw or what conversations I had. I don't even remember what I ate, and food is so important to me. The dinner reminds me of a time when I was still working at NBC. We were doing a press event at the Langham in Pasadena, and I was told John Stamos needed access to one of the hotel rooms in order to rest before his interview. My boss told me they didn't have any empty rooms left and that I would have to give his publicist my key. My room hadn't been serviced yet that day, so I ran up to make it Stamos ready. My friend was in there using the space to get ready for the press event, and I stormed into the room and yelled, "We need to get all of this shit out of here! Stamos is coming!" It was pure panic. We then cleaned the room at a terrifyingly quick pace, realizing the only thing standing between John Stamos and a nap was the two of us. We scrubbed and tidied and hoped he wouldn't be able to tell the bed had been slept in. As soon as we were done, I ran down to the bar where I had been told Stamos' publicist was waiting, and I went in, walked up to the bar where she was having a drink, and proudly presented the key for the room and said, "This is for you." "What is this for?" she responded. "I was told John Stamos needed a room to rest in before the interview, so this is the key for the room." "Oh, thanks. He doesn't need it anymore," she said as she took a sip of her drink. John fucking Stamos. Again, no one understood the stress and panic that went on behind the scenes. They asked for the key, and they got the key, and that was all they knew. Over time, the stress and panic I would feel in these situations dissipated. They stopped as soon as I realized what I needed to get done would get done, even if I stayed relaxed. Soon after this change, I would be too relaxed, and Conan would get upset because he took it as a sign that I didn't care enough. That being at ease meant I didn't feel the urgency that was necessary in certain situations. And he was right. I overcompensated. It takes a lot for me to get nervous now. John Stamos needs a room? Cool, he'll get one when it's ready. Conan O'Brien needs his White House correspondent's dinner speech printed out? Neat, I'll put on my dress and grab my ticket so I can easily get past the Secret Service, and I'll take care of that as soon as I can. This is the dawn of a new day, one in which I'll sit down next to Stamos's publicist and grab a few drinks. Then, when I'm ready, I'll do what needs to be done. If you're thinking, gee, Sona, this sounds like an awful approach to work, you're right. I'll never get hired for another job. But at least, I won't be stressed about it. Filler. I was hiking with my friend Liesl when she told me to write this book. I thought, great, maybe I can make enough money to remodel my kitchen. What I didn't think about was how much work this was going to be. I don't know why I thought writing a book would be easy, but it's not. Plus, I have a set number of words I have to write, and I procrastinated so much that I am now scrambling to get it all done. Since I wrote my proposal, a global pandemic hit, and I bought a house, got knocked up, and had two adorable fat babies. This is a filler section. It's complete nonsense. I'm just typing out words so I can add them to my word count. I'm so bad at completing the tasks I have to complete that in this professional venture, I'm dedicating an entire section to filler. Procrastinating has always been an issue for me. As a refresher for many of you, procrastination is defined as the action of delaying or postponing something. What was I doing instead of writing this book, you may ask? I went through a foreign language phase on Netflix. I started with the Spanish series Money Heist, then watched the French show Call My Agent, and finished it up with the Italian series Summertime. Whenever I finished these shows, I would feel like I was fluent in the languages. Fluent is defined as being able to express oneself easily and articulately. I also watched all seasons of The Great British Baking Show and Dairy Girls. Although they are in English, I felt the sudden urge to speak in an accent. Watching these shows reminded me of the time I was in Japan for my honeymoon. My husband and I went out drinking in the Golden Gai district of Tokyo and stumbled into this bar. We drank all night with a Catalonian, a Brit, two Australians, and one other American. The bartender had a toy alligator, and you would press down on its teeth one by one, and the person who pressed on the tooth that forced the mouth to close would lose. Only we started gambling, and whoever pressed the tooth that forced the mouth to close would win the pot. I lost $200. We were in Japan at the same time Conan was there for Conan Without Borders special. I stopped traveling with Conan to film the specials after Mexico. It became clear early on that I wasn't really necessary. I also could never resign myself to the idea that I couldn't fully explore the countries like I wanted to. We would go to locations and shoot there for hours. It wasn't a vacation. It was work. Really fun work, but work nonetheless. When we were filming in Cuba, I disappeared for an hour and bought a painting. It took forever for me to find the rest of the crew, and I realized I couldn't just aimlessly walk around in a foreign country without having a concrete plan as to how I'd get back to my colleagues. Anyway, after talking to Conan and Jeff Ross, we decided it would probably be better if I stopped traveling with everyone to film the Conan Without Borders series. I didn't contribute anything to the traveling crew. No one noticed my absence. When I was in college, I procrastinated all the time, like so many of you who are listening to this. Because if you bought a book called The World's Worst Assistant, then chances are you can relate. I once pulled an all-nighter and wrote a 12-page, heavily sourced paper for my ideology and propaganda class at USC. I got an A. I don't change my behavior because I don't suffer the consequences, and it's so hard to get motivated when I could take a couple edibles and watch Step Brothers for the 30th time instead of doing the work I'm supposed to do. Step Brothers is a 2008 film starring Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly. It's about two unmotivated, unemployed grown men who still live at home and become stepbrothers once their parents get married. They're delightful morons, and I guess to a certain extent, I see myself in them. I, too, would rub my testicles all over someone's drum kit in an effort to antagonize them. If I had testicles, of course. I don't. Anyway, I took up knitting during the pandemic. I got so wrapped up in it that I started to binge Grace and Frankie so I could have something fun on while I knit. Knitting became a huge distraction for me, and I told my friend Erica that I would knit a scarf for her, and I was on my way until I ran out of yarn. I had made the scarf way too wide, so now I have a short, wide scarf, like a chode. I put it in a drawer and never got back to it. So that's another project I never finished. Grace and Frankie is a show on Netflix following two women in their golden years who discovered their husbands have been cheating on them with each other. It stars Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, Martin Sheen, and Sam Waterston. My neighbor works on it. Let's see, what else? I have a lot of perks in my job. I get to keep all the gifts Conan doesn't want, and people send him some really nice things. Whenever Conan and I have to run an errand together, I look for the most expensive restaurant nearby where we can eat afterward. I've stayed in some really nice hotels, and it has broken me. My real life and my work life are so different in terms of travel accommodations. I remember staying at a Four Seasons for work and the following week going on a personal trip and staying in a yurt in someone's backyard that I found on Airbnb. When we first checked in, my husband and I heard people having sex in the main house. We looked up toward the bedroom window and saw two naked people looking down at us. Other than that, the yurt was cute, but it wasn't the Four Seasons. I wondered if I could change the formatting in a book. If I wrote with a bigger font and wider margins, I wondered if that would translate into the actual publication of this book. I don't know how to increase margins on a single page of a book, so that's what I did in the printed version. Going back to my life as an assistant versus my normal life, I remember I had never flown in a class higher than coach before, and when we went on the tour, I started flying private to all our tour locations. The last stop of the tour was Atlanta, and the plane American Express sponsored for us would be taking Conan back to his family, and the rest of us would have to fly commercial back to LA. As a gift, they flew me back first class. When I stepped into the first class cabin, I was appalled at how close the seats were to each other. After 2 short months of flying private, it became all I would tolerate. I was insufferable. The reality of my life is coach, however. I have coach money. I'm not Beyonce. I don't have the financial capability to fly private, so the adjustment back to what I'm used to was inevitable. It's like taking a hen that's been in a coop her whole life, letting her fly private for 2 months, then putting her back in the coop. Part of the reason this filler section exists is so I can get closer to the word count I agreed to in my contract. Then maybe I'll make private jet money. Just kidding. I won't. This is all I can do. Surprisingly, this has been one of my favorite parts to write. I've heard Stephen King's process is to just start writing a novel and see where it takes him. This section is clearly inspired by that philosophy. I guess I'm like Stephen King. I'm sure he has private jet money. Part 2. After finishing her third episode of The Office for the morning, Sona decides to go to the kitchen and fix herself a snack. As she walks to the kitchen, she can't help but feel like she's forgetting to do something. What was it that Conan had asked of her? She'll remember eventually, but she hasn't yet. She walks into the kitchen, and the interns are all talking about a new app she's never heard of. The kitchen is where all the interns sit. And there's always a hint of embarrassment when walking in because she knows she's getting more and more out of touch. She doesn't know what happened, but one day she woke up and didn't understand what they were talking about or how to join in. She has to go into the kitchen for the bagels, though. And sometimes there are peanut M&Ms. Every once in a while, they'll have Cheez-Its. And on a good week, there's a lot of white cheddar popcorn. It's worth the risk. She walks in. Sona. Trying to slip into the conversation seamlessly, but coming off painfully old. Kanye, huh? He's crazy. An intern. Yeah. That's it. That's all she has. And now she's awkwardly standing there as six of them watch her cut a bagel, then stick it in the toaster. Good God, she has to wait for it to toast now. It's all so awful. An intern. How's your day so far? Sona. It's good. Conan came in and asked me to do something, and it sounded important, and I completely forgot what it was. The interns are there to learn, and they are learning nothing. Sona looks back at the toaster. Is this the only toaster in the world that takes this long? She can't believe how long this is taking. It's complete agony. There's total silence in the kitchen as six young, eager college students watch Sona watch her toasting in the toaster. Finally, one chirps up. An intern. Are you worried he'll be mad? Sona. Not really. I'm sure I'll remember what he wants eventually. The toaster dings. There is no sound in the world more glorious. She gets the cream cheese from the fridge. The interns watch as she glops the cream cheese on her bagel. Is it too much? Is the bagel too hot? And is the cream cheese melting? Does she look like an asshole? Sona. Did you guys know Michael B. Jordan is filming something here? An intern. Yes. Sona. He was driving on the lot the other day and stopped a friend of mine while she was walking so he could tell her she was beautiful. Then he drove off. The interns collectively gasp. Sona did it. She impressed the interns. Just in time, too. Her bagel is fully cream cheesed and she's ready to leave the kitchen. And now, she wants to visit her friend Erica. She visits her every day. Sona. Bye, guys! Sona leaves the kitchen and veers toward Erica's desk. Sona. Hi, Erica! Erica keeps her head down. She knows if she acts busy, this will deter Sona from staying at her desk too long. Erica. Hey! Erica then looks back at her computer, visibly busy. Sona leans further down over her cubicle wall. Sona. Are you working? Erica. Yes. Sona. Do you need a hug? Erica. Ugh, fine, but you know the rules. No longer than 3 seconds. Sona hugs Erica. She sits there, limp. Sona always hugs too hard and closes her eyes. Erica is a professional. While Sona is the quintessential extrovert, Erica is an introvert. They are opposites as people, but by visiting Erica's desk every day when they first started working together, Sona broke Erica down, and now Erica will never be able to get rid of her. Erica, 1, 2, 3. Okay, that's enough. Sona lets go. She appreciates these small victories. Sona, okay, I'm going to go back to my desk now. Maybe Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip will give you a call later. Erica, please no. Sona goes back to her desk with her bagel. She sits down and promptly calls Erica. Erica sees her calling and picks up reluctantly. Erica, what? Sona, in an awful English accent that sounds like the part of Mrs. Doubtfire where she has a plate of whipped cream on her face and shoots up behind the refrigerator and yells, "Hello! Erica, this is Queen Elizabeth. I'm calling from London, England." Erica, this is awful. Sona, her voice getting higher, the English accent is getting more offensive. "I just wanted to tell you that if you were ever in London, you should come to Buckingham Palace for some tea and crumpets. It'll be most splendid." Erica, can I just hang up, please? Sona, her impression is at its absolute worst. "Hold on, Prince Philip wants to talk to you." Sona switches to another awful English accent that sounds like a combination of Daryl Hammond doing a Sean Connery impression on SNL, John Lithgow's Winston Churchill from The Crown, and a little bit of Neil Diamond singing America.
"Erica! This is Prince Philip! I was just out hunting pheasants!"
Erica. Wow. Okay. Sona, as Prince Philip in a way Prince Philip has never sounded.
"Anyway, as the queen, my wife, said, you should come over one day and hang out."
Erica, hang out? This is a waste of both our time. Sona, incoherently, terribly, and offensively British.
"It was lovely talking to you, Erica. Goodbye.
Sona hangs up the phone and chuckles to herself. She looks at her email, and she has 68 unread messages. It's time to do some work, or Conan is going to know she doesn't remember what he asked her to do. She repeats her mantra. It'll come to me eventually. Professionalism. I've interacted with people from news, politics, entertainment, and so many other fields. Professionalism is key if you want to be taken seriously. On email or on the phone with strangers, my tone changes. I'm a different person. Sometimes I think it would be hilarious if Conan were the only person privy to how unprofessional I can be, as if he's yelling into an abyss about how unprofessional I am and everyone else is thinking, that's not my experience with her. In fact, I found her to be quite impressive. So what is professionalism? I've learned it's being cognizant of the people you're interacting with and keeping a very specific line between who you really are and who you should be in a work environment. Someone who is doing keg stands on Saturday will roll into work on Monday and write an email that includes the phrases, "We'll circle back," and "We can cross that bridge when we get to it." I am one of those people. At work, I find myself laughing too hard at the slightest hint of humor. I've said the phrase, get down to brass tacks, to more people than I'd like to admit. But with Conan and me, as his assistant, our professionalism eroded not long after I started. Instead of allowing Conan to make jokes at my expense without reacting, I started to engage. That was my first mistake. Then, before I knew it, I was calling him a dick on camera, and he was calling me a crazy Armenian. And my lack of professionalism wasn't just directed at Conan. One day, my friend at work, Dixon, was eating some popcorn. I saw him holding a bunch in his hand, and I walked up to him and smacked all the popcorn out of his hand and started laughing at him. I did to him what Conan does to me every day. I continued the cycle of psychopathy. Anyway, later that day, Dixon saw me walking in the parking structure and thought it was the best time for him to get me back for my joke. He yelled out his window, "I'll get you, you stupid bitch!" Only it wasn't me. The woman looked like me from behind, but it wasn't until he had yelled what he had yelled that he drove past her and saw that it wasn't me. Sometimes I think about how terrified that woman must have been, just walking along and minding her own business, then having someone in a Mini Cooper scream obscenities at her in the parking structure. I hope she's okay. Anyway, I grew up with a strong work ethic. My parents instilled the importance of work into both my brother and me, all based in an urgent need to get ahead that is found so often in immigrant communities. We both started working at a young age, and we were punctual and respectful, other than the time I got fired from the Hollywood Bowl, of course. The older I got, the less I gave in to professional conformity. That's when I started to take notice of how the job was servicing me and not vice versa. Sure, this job pays well, but do I want to come in on Mondays? My mental well-being took precedence, and my freedom to be myself was the new priority. And I am not a professional person at work. I like to do my work, but also have fun. I know that means there are some careers I'm not cut out for, DMV worker, Supreme Court justice, commercial pilot, neurosurgeon, nanny, but in most jobs I found, it's entirely possible to find the right balance. Now my parents look at what's become of me. Their daughter is literally writing a book about her experience as a TV assistant called The World's Worst Assistant. They're horrified. I call Conan all kinds of names in public, but that's the environment that was created, and it's the environment I've embraced. This is the new American dream. Stalking. Every once in a while, someone comes on the show who I'm genuinely excited about. Not that every guest isn't a thrill, but some are more exciting to me than others. By chance, they're usually always men and they're usually always attractive. I tend to do the same thing every time. I dress up extra cute that day and spend extra time doing my hair and makeup, as if they'll see me and care. And I always end up in the green room before the show, even though most of the time I watch the show from my desk. And yet, even with all that effort, I hide as soon as they walk in, as if I'm playing coy. I don't want to seem too eager, otherwise they won't fall in love with me. So instead, I play hard to get. Has it ever worked, you ask? Fuck no. Why would that idiotic approach work? I'll paint you a picture. So I've always loved Slash. He was one of my first crushes ever since he walked out of that chapel in those leather pants and jacket with no shirt on in the November Rain video and tore it up on that guitar. He's part of the reason I married someone who can play the guitar. He would come by the show often because he knew Jimmy Vivino pretty well, and he would do bits on the show every once in a while. When he walked into the green room, I would immediately place myself behind a large plant. I wanted a place that was covert enough for him to kind of see me, but transparent enough for me to clearly see him. I would stand there drooling and breathing heavily until he was called onto the stage for whatever he was doing. Then I would emerge from behind the plant and act like nothing was out of the ordinary. I would watch all attractive guys I have a crush on from behind a plant in the green room. Quick side note. Conan once hosted the Warner Brothers panel at Comic-Con. It was the year both Justice League and King Arthur Legend of the Sword were coming out. I went with Conan to the San Diego Convention Center, and I was in a holding area while Conan was in Hall H commencing his hosting duties. At one point, I had to get something we'd left behind in the car, so I took the elevator down and grabbed it. On the way back up, I was in the elevator, and as the doors were closing, a big, beautiful hand reached in and stopped them. In walked Henry Cavill, followed by Charlie Hunnam. It was just the three of us in the elevator, and I was sweating. It was a quick ride, but it felt an hour long. They were talking to each other, and if you held a gun to my head now, I couldn't tell you a single word that passed between them because I was so mesmerized by their handsome faces. It was like the time my junior high crush asked me if he could borrow a pencil, and all I remember was looking down at his hands and muttering a pathetic, "Sure." I then remember telling him to follow me to the classroom where I had already put all my stuff, and then reaching into my pencil box, which was emblazoned with Peckle, a Sanrio character, and giving him my favorite pencil, which I thought he'd appreciate. Although thinking about it now, how the fuck would he know that that was my favorite pencil? It was my chance, and I blew it by being a complete loser, and I felt like I was doing that again in the elevator. An icebreaker like a confident, "Love your work," to both of them could have been a game changer. But no, instead, I stood there, sweating and staring. And then they left. I had never wanted a plant to be in an elevator so badly. Anyway, the reason I bring up my green room technique is because it came in handy when Conan hosted the Core Gala in the beginning of 2020 and Leonardo DiCaprio was among the attendees. I hadn't realized Leonardo DiCaprio would be there until I was searching for a restroom and walked down to a lower level and saw him look up to see if I was someone important. Naturally, he went back to his conversation as soon as he realized I was not. Because Conan was hosting the event, I was expected to be on hand backstage in case he needed me to get Mike Sweeney or drink or a snack or whatever else. Instead, I spent the majority of the night stalking Leonardo DiCaprio. When Leo took a break to catch up with a friend outside, who was there behind a plant? Yep, yours truly. When he was at the bar getting a refreshing beverage, who was nearby also getting a drink? That's right, me again. When he was chatting with Julia Roberts, who was sitting at a nearby table where she wasn't assigned, just covertly staring? You guessed it, me. That was my whole night. It was like a dance only one of us knew we were having. I had zero intention of speaking to him or interacting with him in any way. I just wanted to look at him. Now that I type it out, I realize how creepy it is. I shouldn't be working in the entertainment industry, especially not in a job where I am constantly meeting, helping, and otherwise interacting with major celebrities. But really, I'm more a danger to myself than to anyone else. After a substantial amount of stalking, I realized I had done enough. There was a point where I had to reflect on what I'd done all night. I had ignored my work responsibilities because I was too busy following around a movie star just to look at him. And I wasn't a teenager who was following around the Beatles. I was a grown adult woman who had a mortgage. I was at a work event. So instead of continuing to follow him midway through the night, I changed my approach. I sat at my table, positioned myself so the centerpiece would be blocking me, and just stared at him from my seat like a normal person. I can't remember how Conan did that night, but I'm sure I told him he did a great job. Golf carts. Employees at both the Universal and Warner Brothers lots use golf carts to easily get around their massive campuses. They're zippy and fun and an easy way to get from point A to point B on a big movie lot. They're also so quintessentially a Hollywood tool. You see executives and stars getting around in golf carts in movies made about movies. It was exciting when I first knew I'd have one at my disposal. But I quickly learned golf carts are no joke. Here are three different stories involving golf carts. One doesn't involve me at all, but like the others, it's a great example of professionalism. Or lack thereof. A golf cart love story. In 2009, when Conan was filming The Tonight Show at the Universal lot, two of our interns took a golf cart out on an errand and one came back injured. The intern driving, we'll call him Jack, had a crush on the passenger intern. We'll call her Rose. Yes, after the movie, because any prospect of romance sank like the Titanic after this golf cart ride. To get back to the office as quickly as possible, and in an effort to impress Rose, Jack took full advantage of the hilly terrain of the Universal lot and pretended he was driving a Chevy Corvette on an open road. Although golf carts can only go so fast, when you're heading down on an incline, speed builds. When there are no doors or windows, speed building is not always a good thing. Rose was having a blast at first, enjoying the back lot at Universal, zipping by at a whopping 20 miles per hour. It quickly became pretty clear, however, that Jack was losing control the steeper the hills got. The look of joy on their faces turned to dread as they realized their vulnerability. Even worse, a turn was coming up. Jack braced himself as he took the left turn far too fast, barely keeping the golf cart from flipping over. Once the turn was done, he breathed a sigh of relief and looked over to Rose to gauge her reaction. Only she wasn't there. She had flown out of the golf cart. Not a graceful tuck and roll or a harmless tumble. She was thrown out of the golf cart like a rag doll, like she was made of straw. She was clearly injured, and Jack looked at her body on the ground, knowing any prospect of him asking her out had vanished as she lay there, bleeding and moaning from pain. What's worse is someone on a nearby tour tram had seen and stopped the tram to see if she was okay. The entire tram of tourists sat there with their mouths agape and cameras clicking. What a joy it must have been for them to travel all the way to Los Angeles from wherever they were and get a tour on a real live movie lot. They'd witness a college student take a turn too fast and a second college student fly out of the moving golf cart with the words, "The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien," emblazoned on the side in massive letters. They probably thought it was a part of some stunt show. The tram tour guide called the lot security, and multiple security golf carts and the lot's firefighters all showed up, also in golf carts. They tended to Rose's injuries and asked Jack a ton of questions about what happened. Because the golf cart belonged to the show, our office coordinator got a call, and before long, everyone at the show had heard what happened. Once we knew Rose was okay, the tables turned on Jack. No one had ever heard of someone blowing their chance with a crush because they were responsible for them flying out of a moving golf cart before. We made fun of him relentlessly for the rest of his internship. When Conan's children were stuck in a lagoon. Interns aren't the only ones who abuse the golf carts. I, too, have had mishaps with them. And I'm not talking about the time a few of us took the golf cart out of the lot and drove it on the street to get ramen. We took them at their word when they called our golf carts street legal. And before we knew it, there were angry drivers tailing us in their Chevy Tahoes because we were holding up traffic on Barham Boulevard. We were just begging to get killed on the road, but we went and had ramen and returned without any injuries. But I'm not talking about one of those times. I'm talking about the time I was giving Conan's children a tour of the lot on the golf cart and got stuck in a hole. When Conan's children, Nev and Beckett, came to visit him at work, it was the only time I was ever truly on my A-game. They would get dropped off, spend the day sitting in on meetings and hanging out with their dad, and if he had to go do something they couldn't join in on, I would play video games with them or take them around the lot. On this particular day, I decided it would be a good idea to give them a tour of the Warner Brothers backlot. The backlot is fun to explore. You can see houses from Full House and Gilmore Girls, drive around where they did exterior shots for Friends and ER, and see the famous Warner Brothers water tower. There's also a lagoon. According to my friend who was a tour guide on the Warner Brothers lot, the lagoon was used for Jurassic Park, ER, Gilmore Girls, Pretty Little Liars, and so many other productions. It's near where they would shoot exterior shots for True Blood. On the day I gave Conan's kids a tour, however, the lagoon was empty. It was a large, empty hole surrounded by trees. So for reasons I still don't understand, I thought it would be a good idea to drive into the hole. Maybe to get a better look? Maybe because it was empty and seemed inviting? Or maybe it's because I'm just very dumb. So when I took Nev and Beckett, who at the time were 10 and 8 years old respectively, into the empty, sunken-in expanse, I thought they would think it was cool. And it was. When we tried to get out, however, the golf cart couldn't handle the incline out of the hole. We would back up, build up momentum, drive halfway up the hill to get back to the main road, then slowly slide back down into the empty lagoon. We did this far more times than I'd like to admit. At one point, I asked Nevin Beckett to get out of the golf cart to lower the amount of weight in it, thinking that would help. But if I had to bet on who out of the three of us was weighing down the golf cart, it wouldn't be the two children. It would be the grown woman who got them in the hole in the first place. No one drove by, so we were on our own. Luckily, instead of thinking I was pathetic, they thought it was funny. At first, I did too. But then I started to worry about how I would ever get this stupid golf cart out of this empty lagoon. I considered leaving it there and sending interns to pick it up and letting them figure it out.